Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 283, and we're going to take a deep dive into electric camper vans. That is, vans that are propelled by electricity, because someone I know went really deep. We're also going to talk about running the exhaust from your diesel heater out the wall instead of out the bottom, a place to visit that is a winter wonderland, and how to get drugs. We'll get to that part. Anyway, welcome. Happy December, everyone. Thank you for joining me once again. As a reminder, I will be heading to Malta this weekend, and I will not be doing a podcast for next week, but I should pick it up the following week and tell you all about van life in Malta, which, as I've said, is very limited. But Malta is a beautiful place, and I do encourage everybody to visit if they can. So I have a friend named Tom. Tom and I have traveled a little bit together. We braved the waters of the Bermuda Triangle and survived the threats of Death Valley. Tom is a guy who travels, and he does so in vehicles, and he has been interested in the idea of creating an all-electric camper vehicle. A year ago, it seemed like we were just going down the path, and that's exactly where we were going to end up, and now that is much less certain. But Tom hasn't given up on this, and he's decided to dive in and take a much closer look at the realities of this. Specifically, what vehicles could you use, and how applicable are those vehicles to van life? So the two vehicles he really looked at in depth were the eSprinter and the BrightDrop. Now, we've talked about the BrightDrop a lot. This was GM's new van. It was going to replace the aging Chevy Express. And that would have been the end of the era of big American vans. The classic rear-wheel drive vans, they were going to be all gone. And as we know, that didn't happen, and BrightDrop's been canceled, and GM is still going to make the classic van that's basically the same design as 1982 or something. Anyway, BrightDrops are still out there, though. They did make a bunch of them. You can still buy them. They are still maybe being sold in Canada, so there should be some parts and stuff. But remember, with EVs, parts are less of an issue than with gasoline engines because just stuff doesn't wear out. You need brakes. You need other little components as they break, but not a lot wears out. Windshield wipers, you know, stuff like that. Really little stuff. I would be more comfortable having an EV where it was difficult to get parts rather than an internal combustion engine where it was difficult to get parts. But, you know, obviously that's a decision for you. Anyway, just letting you know what the heck a BrightDrop is. Tom visited a BrightDrop in St. Cloud, Minnesota, not far where he was from, and it is the only major service location in Minnesota, and so that's going to be the situation just about anywhere you are. It's kind of the same situation a lot of Sprinter owners find themselves in anyway, where there is basically one hub that can do the service, and you could be 1,000 miles away from it. Those of you who have ever had trouble in the desert southwest of the United States know exactly what I'm talking about. And that is definitely a thing to consider when you're buying a van. You absolutely have to consider, where are you going to get it serviced? You can do some of it yourself. You can use local mechanics for some of the stuff. But there will be times where you need to interface with a dealership for recalls and things like that. And that's why I recommend the Transit over all the other vans. That is its big crown jewel. You can get Transits serviced in many, many, many more places than any other van. But I digress. The motor in the BrightDrop is the same motor that is in the Hummer EV, which means that the motor is going to have support. There are a lot of them out there, and that's a very good thing. It also means that the batteries are also going to be supported the same way. Again, they don't need a lot of support, but there will be firmware upgrades and things like that. And if there is a problem that is systemic, there can be a recall. And the larger number of things having a recall, the better for you, although it could increase wait times. And Tom says that he found that the brakes for the BrightDrop and the Sprinter can actually be done locally. And remember that both of these vans use regenerative braking, which means that when you step on the brakes, the first thing that's going to happen is that the motor is going to reverse, not the vehicle, just the motor, and the energy that is being pulled out of your speed as the vehicle slows is going to get pumped back into the battery. So every time you step on the brakes, you're going to charge the battery a little bit. And of course, if you slam on the brakes, it's going to apply actual brakes with brake pads. The point of that is that you're not going to go through brakes as quickly because you're not going to be actually using your brake pads as much. It's the same way a Prius or many hybrids work. This is not new tech. The BrightDrop, as we've talked about before, is a step van, you know, like a bread truck or a newspaper delivery truck. It's very square, but it is not at all meant for passengers. The driver's seat is comfortable enough, and it's very modern up there, but the back is absolutely not have seats. If you need seating for four, you're going to have to absolutely do something fancy to get that extra seating in the back, and that is tricky, and it probably won't technically be legal or insurable, so there's something to think about. As configured, the BrightDrop comes with just a jump seat for the passenger, which is, if you've ever worked for UPS at Christmas, which I have, jump seat is just this fold-down seat that it's a hard little platform. It's meant for sitting for 5 minutes, not 5 hours. So if you and a spouse were traveling in this thing, you would definitely want to replace that seat somehow. Whereas the Sprinter has, you know, Sprinter seats. It's much, much more comfortable. And you can get actually the fancy seats in the Sprinter. So if you're looking for driving comfort right away, the e-Sprinter is a better option than the BrightDrop. Interesting thing about the BrightDrop is the dashboard. It is absolutely huge. In fact, Kevin thinks that he could possibly turn the cab of the BrightDrop into a separate bedroom. So if you wanted like a kid's bedroom and an adult's bedroom or whatever configuration, there's enough space on the dashboard that if you were clever, you could build a sleeping platform there and somebody could literally have a separate room and then you could close it off. That's an interesting thing. You could arguably do that with the Sprinter. People have done that where they hang a sleeping platform off of the handles or have them sit on the windowsills, things like that. But the BrightDrop would actually be easier. So that's kind of a fun option. Also, he points out that the BrightDrop is not meant for audible comfort either. Everything rattles. I mean, it is really a step van. So it's not acoustically insulated, and it is really not meant for long trips on the highway. It's not an exploration vehicle as configured from the dealer. So that's something to consider too. This is the same problem all step vans have. They're very loud because, well, when they build them, they don't care about that. Now, there's no engine in the BrightDrop, so you don't have that noise, but you're going to have the rattles and the wind noise. And he points out something very important here. You can't drill through the floor between the axles because there's a big battery under there, and that's true for both vans, right? So you have to consider that if you're looking at the layout of the back and, oh, I'm going to put this here and that here, remember that you have very, very limited places where you can drill through the floor to get things out, unlike a traditional internal combustion engine van. So that is a big consideration. In the product review section, I will talk about a possible solution for that, but that is definitely something to consider. The way you design your interior is going to very specifically have to match the needs of an EV vehicle. That said, the BrightDrop is pretty square. You know, the walls and the ceiling are very square, but the top is just a panel that lets light through, so there's absolutely no insulation and also no strength. And it has doors that slide into pockets, which could be good or bad, depending on how you look at it. And the back door is a roll-up garage-style door, which, again, could be good or bad, but is generally bad if you're trying to make a camper out of it. Because when that door goes up, it's going to cover a whole lot of the ceiling, meaning you can't have ventilation there unless it clears the door. Now, I have seen people put these doors in kind of pockets so they disappear. I've seen other people just remove the doors entirely. And in box trucks, what people do sometimes is they'll put in another wall behind the garage door, so the garage door comes down and it gives a stealth effect of, oh, it's just a box truck. But when you lift up the garage door, you see there's windows and a door. And when you're parked somewhere, you would typically leave the door up. But that is something that you have to compensate for, whereas the e-Sprinter has the normal Sprinter doors. You can see the bottom line here is that the e-Sprinter, though it is electric, is actually much more like a traditional Sprinter, whereas the BrightDrop is something completely different. Also consider that if you can't drill between the axles, you also can't mount water tanks or propane tanks or anything under there. So all that stuff is going to have to be internal to the vehicle. Now, the big stuff, the stuff people care about. How far can you go in these things? Well, the e-Sprinter has a smaller battery. It's only 113 kilowatt hours. And, you know, you're still talking way below 300 miles. You probably have a 200-mile safe range before you're going to need to charge one way or another. For me, and this is the big argument in EV land, Brian, if you're listening, yeah, okay, this is what we're talking about. The kind of lifestyle van life folks have, 200 miles is nothing. It's very, very little. And as you're often in remote areas, you are going to have to plan a lot more carefully where you're going to recharge these things. So while the BrightDrop has a bigger battery at 173 kilowatt hours, Tom reported that using a Hummer EV as an example, a vehicle he's familiar with, it takes 30% longer to charge that battery than the Sprinter or a Kia EV6, for example. He has a Kia EV6. He's used to EVs. The EV6 charges in 20 minutes for about $30. Smaller vehicle, smaller battery. The BrightDrop is going to take you an hour. It's going to cost $60 because it's a lot more power. But again, this is a planning thing. It's not a deal killer. It's just a different way of thinking about it. Typically, when I go out on the road in any of my gasoline or diesel-powered vehicles, I plan. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go here. Where is there a gas station near here? And I will fill up before I go too remote. You can do the same with this. You just have to do it more carefully, and you will have fewer options. One thing that is a problem with EV vehicles, and I've gotten pushback on this, but I'm going to stand by it, is that if you go to rural areas, it's harder to find places to charge. And if those rural areas are far from urban areas where there's charging, you've got a problem. And while, yes, you can plug into a regular household outlet if you have to, it'll take forever, but you can do that. Whose household outlet are you going to use? You know, like knock on the door of a farmhouse and say, hey, can I plug my van in for 12 hours and use a whole bunch of your electricity? I mean, I just don't see that happening. Now, if you know somebody, yeah, okay, that's fine. But if you're exploring, I think you're more limited in an EV than you would be with a gasoline engine or a diesel engine. And you also don't have the option of just carrying an extra 5 gallons or 10 gallons of fuel with you, unless you somehow could bring a massive battery, because a Jackery ain't going to get you any more miles than one of these things. And the conclusion of all that is that while the BrightDrop will have more range, it will take longer to charge as well. That's the trade-off. The charging port on the Sprinter is actually in the front grille, so you just pull up to the charging port, and that's pretty easy. From what I've seen about the EV charging stations, that's an easy location to use. In the BD, it's on the rear driver's side where you might have a gas fill, and that can be a little tricky. You might have to back in. It's just going to be a little more difficult to get your cord into the BrightDrop, but that's not a big deal. And he points out that one bonus of having this big battery in the BrightDrop is that it can act as a house backup system. Like if your power goes out, you can actually draw off the battery in the BrightDrop to power things in your house. Just remember, you got to charge the van back up before you head off. He makes a comment here that I disagree with. It's a little bit semantic. Kevin wants to use that one big battery for everything. He doesn't want to have 12 volt or 24 volt batteries in there. I think you still want to have two systems. The batteries that power the vehicle are, to me, comparable to the starter battery in an ICE vehicle, the internal combustion engine vehicle. Whereas for the purposes of van life, you want to keep that sacred. You don't want to draw from that because that's what's going to allow you to move. You want a separate battery system that you can accidentally run down and you won't be in trouble. His approach is different. He says, I've got this big battery. I want to use this big battery for everything. Because of that, he says solar is not useful in an EV vehicle. And he's right. To any mathematical standpoint, the amount of solar power you're going to get out of solar panels, even on a big roof like your BrightDrop or a 170-inch wheelbase Sprinter, It's just a drop in the bucket. It just isn't enough to matter for that big battery. And it would be weird adapting it, because the solar panels that you can just get off the shelf aren't designed for charging batteries at the voltage that the vehicle runs at. So I would have a separate battery system in there. You know, I'd throw in 300 or 400 amp hours of regular old lithium iron phosphate batteries, or maybe some of those sodium batteries if they become more mainstream, and have that be separate. And in that case, solar is useful. And these roofs are great for solar. Now, the BrightDrop roof, you would have to put some sort of support under it. And the eSprinter roof is just a standard metal roof. You know how to do that. If you don't, there's plenty of support. So the back of the BrightDrop is fiberglass with aluminum studs. So you would probably try to run anything strong to those aluminum studs, and you could put 2x4s or 1x1s or whatever piece of wood you wanted. You could do aluminum struts between the existing struts, whatever you wanted. But you have these points of strength that you would ultimately attach everything to. That's fine. And the Sprinter, of course, is it's the same body, basically, as a regular Sprinter. So you're dealing with the steel walls. I prefer the BrightDrop in this case because it's more like carpentry than dealing with the curved, thin steel walls of the Sprinter. And I just think it would be a much, much easier build in the BrightDrop. But while you would think that, Kevin points out that there's more space in the BrightDrop, but a lot of wasted space because of the sliding cab doors that go into these pockets that you can't really do much with. And that roll-up door, you got to deal with that too. So that's not such a great thing. And you're going to be able to buy accessories for your Sprinter. If you want to buy window covers or whatever for the Sprinter, that's just a matter of buying them. BrightDrop, you're doing everything on your own. In fact, I don't think there are any windows. You will be adding windows if you want windows. And the size is a bit different. The Sprinter 170 will fit in a typical parking space, usually. The BrightDrop, less so. It's a bit wider. It's a bit longer. It is a delivery van. So it's going to be more awkward in city situations. Just keep that in mind. Kevin crawled under both of these vans and found the undersides to be very, very complex. Now, he is very much interested in aerodynamics. He would actually go to the effort of making it completely smooth under there to improve aerodynamics. This is beyond what I think most people would do. But it's interesting to note that it is very complex under there, and that is going to alter your design. So you're going to have to make sure that you understand what you're getting into before you actually start building. He also pointed out that the eSprinter, which is only two-wheel drive, has fewer motors, and so there's less risk of heat. And that doesn't matter so much unless you're going to do what he's thinking of, which is cover the entire bottom of the vehicle with a panel to reduce wind resistance. Bottom line on turning into a camper van, he thinks the eSprinter will be significantly easier, not only because there is stuff you can buy ready-made, but also because you have support of years and years of people converting Sprinters into camper vans, which is very interesting. Because he's a creative guy. He can build things himself. And even though the BrightDrop has nice square walls and this big open area, he's thinking that the Sprinter would actually be easier. However, there is a however. BrightDrop vans are pretty inexpensive right now. So they're like $95,000 list price, but some are available brand new right now for about $42,000. And if you get the extended battery, which is what we've been talking about $52,000. And I would absolutely say that $10,000 is worth it for that extra battery. That extra range is something you are going to want. How much does it cost to drive an EV per mile versus a diesel van? So he did the math with a little help from AI and stuff. I believe he's an engineer by trade, so I trust his numbers. He believes the eSprinter will cost 9 cents a mile, a BrightDrop 7 to 8 cents a mile, and a diesel van 29 cents a mile. And of course, that's going to change a lot depending on fuel prices and where you are in the country and which van you have, because not all diesel vans get the same mileage. He also said that in Canada, there's a new electric van coming out, the Kia PV5, which honestly looks like the Canoe. Remember the Canoe, the van that I actually bought stock in Canoe? That was a waste. It's a van similar to the ID Buzz, but it's a mini electric minivan, basically. It's not scheduled to come to the U.S. because we can't have nice things. But he thinks that might be an interesting platform, and I agree. You would have all the support of Kia and a nice small package. I would take a look at that. Those are Kevin's thoughts. I really appreciate him sharing those with me. Basically, his bottom line is that the Sprinter is a better choice, even though the BrightDrop wins in distance between charges and interior space and price. Right now, bike drops are fairly inexpensive. If you get a Sprinter, it's a known quantity. Even though support for Sprinters is terrible relative to other vans, it's going to be better than for the bike drop. There you have it. If you are thinking of jumping into electric van life, there's some data for you. Personally, in my opinion, it's not time yet, at least not in the United States. The right van hasn't come along. This is still going to be fringe stuff, and it's only going to fit the right person in the right place. Thanks to everyone who has visited buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Because of you, and those of you who have bought me some gallons, there will be no ads on this podcast. If you would like to help support the podcast, visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you can help enjoy the ad-free airwaves. Airwaves? I mean, this isn't radio, but a lot of people are getting this over Wi-Fi, so yeah, I think that counts. Van life news. And this is just one item, but it's an important item, and thanks to John for pointing this out. Amazon Leo now has a sign-up so that you can know when it's available. What is Amazon Leo? It is a Starlink competitor. And I think this is huge. Starlink is an amazing thing. It has changed the world. It has brought high-speed internet to virtually every surface of the planet. A very, very big deal. And yes, the company is controversial. There have been some things that have happened. Their pricing is bizarre. It changes all the time. All that stuff, yes. But the point is that competition will help smooth all that out. This is one of the good effects of capitalism. And I am not here to tell you that capitalism is the best system in the world or anything like that. I'm just pointing out that there is one good aspect of capitalism is that when two companies are competitive, generally their products become better and the prices go down. And I think that's what's going to happen here. And what we will have then is it'll be kind of like Verizon and AT&T in the cell phone market. They're going to keep fighting against each other, and things are going to get better and better and better. At least I hope. And so basically, we're going to have Musk and Bezos in the ring boxing it out, and hopefully the coins will fall from their pockets, and we can scoop them up in the form of high-speed internet wherever we want it to be. It looks like it's going to be comparable to Starlink. Some of the specs are like a little better than Starlink, but honestly, I don't care about any of that. All I care about is being able to get internet wherever I want and how much it's going to cost. We can talk about the hardware when it's out and, you know, this one has 12-volt hardware, this one doesn't, the antenna's bigger, all that stuff. We'll deal with that later. All I'm telling you this for is that if you want to sign up and be on the waiting list for possibly investigating Amazon Leo, you can do that. And shockingly, the URL is Leo, like the lion and the constellation and the astrological sign, leo.amazon.com. Tech Talk! I am continually getting in trouble on this topic, so I'm going to come clean. I'm going to state my opinion here, and anybody who disagrees is welcome to come at me. But I don't want to just come out flat out say I'm right. But the more I research this issue, the more evidence I find that I'm right. So here's the deal. Insulation. Yes, I said the I word. I can already feel the slings and barbs coming my way. People in van life are obsessed with insulation. We're not going to talk about sound insulation here, although they are directly related. Just temperature insulation. Let's start with a basic concept. What is insulation for? If you said to keep things hot or to keep things cold, I will give you a C. The A answer is, insulation is that which slows the transfer of temperature from one side to the other. It is a thing that causes thermal inertia. Eventually, the inside of an object and the outside of an object are going to be the same temperature. In the amount of time can be mitigated with insulation. Okay, so think of a thermos of hot coffee. If it's just a glass bottle, very little insulation, your coffee is going to cool off very quickly and assume room temperature. Then you put some bubble wrap around it and it cools off a little bit slower. Or if you put it in a nice vacuum thermos, it could last a lot longer. But in time, it's going to assume room temperature. It's no different with your van. And so what happens is people think about this and they think, oh man, I'm going to be camping in the winter and it's going to be really cold. So I want to keep the inside of my van hot and the outside cold, basically. And I will get a heater and then I will put in a whole bunch of insulation and then I will be nice and toasty warm and I will be using the least possible energy to keep myself warm. And I have no disagreement with that. None. That is absolutely correct. Or the converse. I'm going to be camping in the desert and I've got an air conditioner, but it really struggles. What can I do? Well, if I put a bunch of insulation in, that will help my air conditioners keep the area cooler. And again, I have no disagreement. The disagreement comes with practicality. In either of those situations, people are forgetting something, and that is that their vans have wheels. And they are going to use those wheels to go places, and those places are going to have different weather. Also, the weather is not static. It changes over the course of a day. And here is what made me get into this line of thinking. When I was driving around the desert Southwest doing my Aurora project, it would be 85, 90 during the day, and it was miserably hot in the back of the van. I insulated the heck out of that van. This is little NV 200. I put in as much insulation as I possibly could. Floor, ceiling, walls. I stuffed rock wool in the pillars. I had 1-inch polyiso wherever I could, which is a very thick insulation. And I had to use Reflectix in a few areas where nothing else would fit. This was a well-insulated van. And what I found is that at 10 o'clock in the morning, it would be a little bit cooler inside the van, but by noon, it would either be the same temperature in the van as outside, or even hotter, because don't forget that glass amplifies heat. Heat can come into the van, but can't bounce out. And so, even though I didn't have windows back there, I still had front windows and side windows. Okay, fine, right? So I could have gotten an air conditioner. At the time, that wasn't practical. But the practical thing was that I would, at night, drive somewhere that would be cooler. And I was aiming for it to be below 80 degrees at night. So I would either go up or go north, or I would look at the weather. And I would find a place to sleep, and it would be fine. And I would park there, and I would look at the thermometer, and it would be 80 degrees. And I'm like, okay, it's fine. And then I would look at the internal thermometer, and it would be 89 degrees. It's 89 degrees in the van, it's 80 degrees out of the van. I'm like, what? And so, like, okay, so I turn on the vent and open the windows, and an hour later, it's 87. And then it took, like, 4 or 5 hours for all that heat to get out of the van. Meanwhile, it's 72 out, I'm still sweating inside the van. And the problem was the insulation. The insulation had slowed down the cooling of the inside of the van, and that was something I wanted in that circumstance. And that isn't that strange of a circumstance. And you might argue, okay, yeah, you just didn't have enough ventilation. Ventilation absolutely can help, but it's a lot to remove that heat. Remember that when your van heats up, it's not just the air heating up, it's everything. If you have 5 gallons of water in your van, that 5 gallons is also heating up, and it takes a long time to cool down 5 gallons of water. Water holds energy really well. Your insulation itself holds heat. You can put your hand up to it and think it's not warm, but that heat's in there. I mean, where else did it go? The sun's beating down on your van and the heat is going right into your insulation. Caveat here, that is thermal transfer insulation like fiberglass or rock wool or even wool versus radiant insulation like Reflectix. Heat bounces off of Reflectix, so it's a different story. Anyway, bottom line is, there's a lot of heat stored in your van in different places, and it needs to get out. And if you insulate it well, it has no way to get out. So practically, for the way I camp, where I am not plugged in at night, I don't have air conditioning, it is better for me to have less insulation. And then you're like, oh no, but if you have less insulation, what about the winter? Well, guess what, folks? It is not hard to overheat your van to compensate for any lack of insulation. You can heat a tent. They make tent heaters. In fact, they make diesel heaters just for tents. It's called hot tent camping. You can be completely comfortable in a tent which has literally no insulation at all. So to my mind, insulation should be minimal. You want the least amount necessary, unless you are always camping at an extreme or you always have power. In something like my Airstream, where I have heating and air conditioning, insulation makes a lot more sense because I'm always going to keep the inside at the same temperature. It's a house on wheels. A van is a vehicle. You're going to be driving it during the day, and generally you're not going to be heating it all day long or cooling it all day long unless you're in it. Different people do different things. If you have pets, of course, you're going to do something different. But if you're driving from place to place, you're not going to do much with the back, and it's going to heat up or cool down, and then you're going to have to bring it back to temperature, and the insulation can get in the way with that. Just a couple other little notes, and then I'll get off my high horse. Insulation can also store moisture, which will then be released, which can be a problem. We talked a lot about the different kinds of insulations and how to avoid that, and this is where the idea of moisture barriers come up, and let's just say, no, I don't think moisture barriers are a good idea. That's a whole other nasty topic. And so to summarize this in 5 bullet points, okay? Insulation slows heat transfer both ways, and sometimes that's a problem. Moisture has a harder time escaping. Yes, that's true. Ventilation can compensate for that, okay? You become dependent on active climate control. The more insulation you put in your van, the more dependent you're going to be on creating the heat or removing the heat with some air conditioner or heater or other mechanism. You lose the ability to equalize instantly. Think of a tent, right? A tent has no insulation. If it's hot out, it's hot in the tent. If it's cold out, it's cold in the tent. It's almost instant transfer. And if you've been driving through the desert all day and the van is hot, but the temperature drops a lot at night, you want to take advantage of that, and you can't if you have a lot of insulation. And the truth is, you don't need it. Also consider how much insulation costs, what a pain it is to install, how much space it takes up. It adds weight to your rig. It gets in the way of troubleshooting. Like, oh, I've got a short somewhere. One of my wires has come loose. It's behind all the insulation. And animals can build homes in it. Ask me how I know that. So, bottom line, I think you want to do a very thin layer of insulation to help fight condensation, less than an inch for sure. You want to have a good amount of ventilation, and a diesel heater is a great thing to have, unless you are always staying in Florida or something like that. A diesel heater has enough power to keep your van warm, even if you have no insulation at all. Okay, I am off the soapbox, and the comments are open. Product review. That's twice I've mentioned diesel heaters so far. I have a problem that is similar to the folks in EV campers, which is that I can't put anything through the floor. I'm talking about my truck cap here. The truck cap has to be able to come off the truck. That is a requirement I am giving it. It has to be removable. If I had decided it was never going to be removed, then I could do different things. But my requirement is the truck cap has to be removable. Therefore, I can't go through the floor into the truck in any way, shape, or form. But I want to have a diesel heater. How am I going to do that? How am I going to run the exhaust out? Well, practically, I've got 2 choices. I either have to go through the ceiling, which I can, there's actually some advantages to that, or I have to go through the walls. Either way, this device on Amazon will help me. The description is stainless steel 316 diesel heater exhaust port, 24 millimeter diesel heater exhaust pipe through wall, through hull pipe outlet for diesel heaters, through hull fitting for boats, trucks, garage, diesel heaters straight. And it is from a company called Kosoeur, K-O-S-O-E-U-R. Obviously, there's a lot of people making these things. They cost about $15. They come in 2 basic variants, one that has a straight pipe on the inside and one that has an angled pipe. It's about maybe 100 degree angle. All this thing is a stainless steel hole. You drill a hole in your van and you stick this thing in there, and then it comes with gaskets, seals against the side or the roof of your van, and then you hook up your diesel exhaust to this. That's it. It provides a safe way to get a hot exhaust pipe through the wall of your van. It's an insulated thing, not directly insulated, but there's a collar that goes around the part you connect the exhaust pipe to, and that dissipates heat enough. An interesting effect of using this thing is you're going to get more heat because the exhaust pipe is going to be in your van, and heat will come off of that. And you could even be a little clever. I haven't quite figured out all this, but I've heard people talk about it. You could run the exhaust pipe in such a way that it heated water. You could actually have hot water from this too. That requires a lot more engineering than I'm doing in this segment. Now, some of you with experience are like, this is a terrible idea. Because what this means is the exhaust hose will clamp to your diesel heater inside your van, and then it will run and then clamp to this thing inside your van. That creates two points where exhaust could possibly leak into your van. And you know what? You're right. That is absolutely a big concern. So if you do this, you have to be very, very careful that those connections are perfectly sealed. Your diesel heater comes with hose clamps or Jubilee clips, as they're called in other parts of the world. You probably don't want to use those. You're probably going to want to get better, heavier duty ones. And then you're going to want to test it. Now, how do you test this? Basically, while the thing is starting up before it gets too hot, you can do the soapy water thing like you do with propane, but you don't want it to get too hot because you don't want burning soap in your rig. And you do the same thing. You get some soapy water, say 50-50 Dawn and water, whatever, and put it on a sponge or paper towel, and then wipe it around the connections and see if there are any bubbles. If there are, you're not done. You are not allowed to use this heater until those bubbles go away, because this is a big safety thing. Also, you're going to have this big hot exhaust hose in your van that you're going to have to find a place to make safe. I have not quite figured out how I'm going to do this. I might go out of the wall. The problem with going out of the wall is that it'll be at the same height that if somebody's walking by, they could actually get burned. Like if I were parked next to another vehicle and the driver of that vehicle walked by and they brushed up against it, it would melt their coat. Also, there's no muffler. You have to take the muffler off for this, because the muffler, no matter what, cannot be inside your rig, because the muffler is not airtight. It has holes to let moisture escape. So you have to put the exhaust outside. And while you could attach the exhaust to this, then you've got this really weird gangly pipe sticking out the side of your rig or on the roof. In some ways, the roof is a better option, but then you've got the problem of water getting in there, which would be bad, and also it will add height to your vehicle, which is not great either. So I haven't figured this out yet, or at least for me, but if you are in a situation where you want to have a diesel heater and you don't want to run the hose through the floor for whatever reason, one of these $15 things is your answer. These were invented for boats. That's the idea. Boats have the same problem. You can't go out the bottom of a boat either. So they have these, and they are watertight against the wall, so long as you apply them. Get the one that has as many gaskets that come with it as possible. I've seen them that only come with one. I think you want at least two. Link in the show notes, but it is called a diesel heater exhaust port, and I think it's a good solution for some of Tales from the Road. I remember the first time I was ever in an RV, and it wasn't normal. It was 1976. My folks had taken myself and my cousin Stephanie down to Key West. We actually were all over Florida, but I remember we were in Key West, and my dad got this crazy idea to fly from Key West to Marathon Key. Marathon Key is up in the middle of the Keys, and it's so named because it is the same length as a marathon. And where did a marathon get its name? Why, it was the distance an ancient Greek messenger named Pheidippides ran from the battlefield at Marathon, Greece, to Athens. And this island is that long. So if you run from one end of this island to the other, you've run a marathon. And they have an airport. And they have an airport in Key West. And my dad was like, we should fly there. And now, I was, you know, 9 years old. I was like, okay, sure. And the reason my dad wanted to do this was not to visit Marathon. It was a Sunday, as it turns out. There wasn't anything to do there. It was the plane. They had Sunshine Airways, I believe it was, had a DC-3 from 1942 or something, a tail dragger that would fly you up there in like 45 minutes or something. Now, if a DC-3s were an amazing plane, some of them are still flying. These planes fought in every war since World War II, heavy use in the military, and they were the first really reliable passenger plane that was in broad use. I mean, they were the Model Ts of commercial air travel. But even in 76, they were getting pretty old. And I had flown before. I was in a traveling family. I 707s I was very familiar with. This thing was weird. You got into the plane from the outside. There was no jetway or anything like that. Stairs were attached to the door and folded down. But when you got on the plane, the floor wasn't level. The floor tilted towards the back of the plane, because remember I said this was a tail dragger, because the tails literally drag. There's a little tiny wheel at the back of the plane, and then two what we would consider normal-sized wheels under the wings. And you've seen pictures of these things, I'm sure, but it's one of those old planes where the back dragged on the ground. And of course, that's how you had to load. That's how you got on the plane. Now, as you're taxiing down the runway, you are riding, kind of looking up into space, very nicely reclined, as is everyone. Not possible to walk around. There was no issues of people getting up and going to the bathroom, because you were pretty much trapped in your seat. And if you dropped anything, it went all the way to the back of the plane. And then as you started the takeoff process, you would actually gain enough speed that the back of the plane would start to fly first. The wings would level the plane out, and the floor would be normal, and the back of the plane would be in the air, no longer dragging, and then you would launch gracefully into the air and travel at a modest speed to your destination. Landing was the same, although you landed, there's a thing called a three-point landing, apparently, where you land on all three wheels. We didn't do that. We did a two-point landing. The plane landed on its two big wheels and then went down the taxiway, and then suddenly the plane dropped onto its back wheel. And it was only shocking because I wasn't expecting it, even though I should have been. Honestly, it was kind of fun. And completely successful voyage and everything. And we were going to be in Marathon for like 2 hours. So we get off the plane and we walk out of the airport because we have no other transport. And there's like a little strip mall. But it's Sunday in Florida in the 70s. Literally everything is closed. There's nothing to do. And we're hot. So it's the summer. So we're looking for some air conditioning and nothing is open. So we keep walking and walking and walking and walking. And then finally, my mother's like, I've had enough of this. Let's just go back to the airport. And she was not wrong. And so we turned around, went back to the airport. But at that time, my cousin and I were really dragging, and it was just miserably hot, and we were so far away that when this massive vehicle pulled up next to us and honked its horn, we were pretty happy. And what it was, now that I remember, it was a 1973 Winnebago Indian, probably a D-22, which oddly is the same one I own. It took me a while to put this together. And the guy was super friendly, and he had air conditioning in there, and he invited us in. All four of us just climbed into his Winnebago, and he drove us like a mile and a half back to the airport. In fact, he drove us like right onto the runway. He dropped us off by the plane. Things were a little different back then. And we thanked him and waved and stuff, but now that I think about it, that was my very first time in an RV, and it's just weird that I own one of those now. Although his was not a Tiki-Bago, it was merely a Winnebago. And it was only 3 years old at the time, so travel is fun, even when it's not. A place to visit. It's winter! And there's this new thing that I haven't tried yet, so I am not... This is not a review, I'm just suggestion, but it's called ice castles. And no, it is not related to the sappy movie about ice skating from long ago. No, these are places that people are building to take advantage of the cold weather. Like, let's celebrate winter. And basically what they're doing is building a winter wonderland out of ice and snow and doing everything they can to take advantage of it. And they're lighting these things up with beautiful colors. And there are tunnels and sculptures and sledding, and there's a bar, and you can drink a hot cocoa and stuff. And if you have kids, they can go play, and you can just sit there in this kind of winter wonderland. There's a bunch of them in the country, and they're a little hard to describe, but they have ice slides, ice sculptures, crawl tunnels, caverns and archways, an ice bar, and concessions. Now, people have generally reviewed these things positively. It seems like people like them. Some people have reported that the concessions and stuff are expensive. All right, that doesn't seem too surprising. But to get in, the tickets are between $18 and $26 for adults. It's more expensive on weekends because it gets crowded. If you're a senior, which to them is somebody over 55, hello, I'm raising my hand. There's a code, senior26, and you can get 15% off. The thing I really like is that these are in places where winter gets old. You know, having lived in Vermont, and actually Utah was worse, winter can be very pretty, and I like it when I'm nice and cozy warm and there's a storm outside, but winter is also sometimes long. You just get sick of it. This is something to kind of add some fun to it. And apparently they've been doing it for 15 years. I had no idea. They have locations in Cripple Creek, Colorado, Silverthorne, Colorado, Edmonton, Canada, little love for our friends up north, Minnesota, and interestingly, New Hampshire, or as we would say, New Hampshire. I don't know. Seems kind of fun. I would like to try it out. And if you're looking for fun things to do in the winter or while you're traveling or whatever, this is something that you can stick in your quiver. I have a link in the show notes. It is icecastles.com. Pretty simple. And if you can't remember the code, I have it on my show notes as well. It's just senior26. And yeah, let me know if you do go. I would really love to hear a first-hand review of this place. Yeah, it's probably a touristy trap thing, but I don't really care. It looks pretty. Resource recommendation. I have been having trouble with my pharmacy. In Chicago, Walgreens are everywhere, or they used to be everywhere. Walgreens is going through something. I don't know exactly what. They just became privately held and all this stuff, but they have stopped storing drugs at their locations. They have like a central distribution place, so when you go fill a prescription, the drugs have to come from the central distribution. All I can tell you is it doesn't work. From a customer standpoint, getting drugs from Walgreens is a pain in the butt now. And I am on, you know, hey, I'm almost 60. I've got several different drugs I'm on, and you may too as you get to my age. I'm supposed to take them every day, and because of insurance companies, they give you this tight window where you can only get a new one if you have only two pills left, and if you miss something, anyway, you get it. Prescriptions are a pain in the butt in the U.S. So I decided to try Amazon Pharmacy. This gave me some anxiety because, you know, when Walgreens is working properly, I can just drive there and get my prescription. You can't do that with Amazon. But what I found is that Amazon is actually a better place to get drugs because they're more reliable and more efficient. Now, this is not an affiliate link thing. I don't get any affiliate code for pharmacy stuff from Amazon. So put aside your fears there. No, it's just been great. When my prescriptions are due, they send me an email. Do you want to order them? I say yes, and they appear in the mail, and that's it. I don't have to go to the pharmacy. I don't have to worry about them running out of drugs. They're just there. Adding my prescriptions to Amazon was super easy. I just told Amazon what they were and where they were. Amazon went and fetched them. And when they're renewed by my doctor just has Amazon on their list of pharmacies and just sends them there. All that has worked great. Amazon also has a thing called Pill Pack, where they will take all your prescriptions and put them in a single little plastic bag, a little tiny plastic bag, on a roll, and then you get this roll of all your drugs for the day, and they're clearly labeled with what they are, little, you know, what time to take them if you have that on your drugs, and what date it's for. So you can tell if you took your drugs or not. You can tell what days you missed or whatever. And if you're going to go away for 5 days, you can just rip off 5 packets. I would take 6 or 7 just to be safe. And you don't have to take the big bottles with you. However, I have to give them negative marks on the pill pack just due to the way they do it. Pill pack is only useful for some drugs. I take 4 different medications every day. They would only allow me to put 3 of them in the pill pack. So I would have a pill pack with 3 and then a bottle for the other one. Now they've kicked out another drug. So for a while here, I've had a pill pack with 2 drugs and then 2 bottles. And at that point, it's just silly. I mean, the pill pack isn't doing me any good. I would have an easier time with the bottles and then spending a little time every week putting them in my own little boxes or whatever. So if you do pill pack, which is great if it would work, see if your drugs actually can come in the pill pack, because otherwise it's a pain. One huge advantage over this is that it's Amazon, so you can change the delivery location to some extent. Depending on what drugs you are on, it may be difficult to get them in a different state. Some drugs are restricted by prescription by state. But if you're on just like regular old drugs like statins or high blood pressure medicine or whatever, and you're going to go camping and you need your drugs, you can just change the address to a Dropbox and then pick it up there, which is something you can't easily do with Walgreens or whatever. So I'm just saying that I have found it to be a good service. If you are somebody who isn't paying for drugs with insurance, they have discount programs, so you can compare how much it would cost. Just take a look. It might work for you depending on your lifestyle. It has actually saved me a lot of hassles. So I am a fan. I just have quibbles about the pill pack. Guess what the URL is? Yes, it is pharmacy.amazon.com. And yes, I have a link in the show notes. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 283. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, who I'm happy to report has a new place to live now. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. We also have a Facebook group and a Discord channel, and all of that stuff is linked at builttogo.com. Until next time, remember the words of Oscar Wilde, who said, "Wisdom comes with winters."